Be honest. You thought you were getting Belgium 2021 there for a minute, didn't you? Welcome back to Motorsport 101. Consider that bullet well and truly dodged. Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 605 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Glad you could join us once again. It wouldn't be M101 with a bit of off-the-cuff planning. We're recording this on Wednesday night. It's 10:15 UK time. Scrambling, trying to figure out a slot to record this, but we've actually been able to figure this out literally a couple of hours before a certain co-host of mine hits the road for IMSA this weekend. It's just us. We're very snuggly. It's me and RJ O'Connell. Hello, RJ. How's it going, mate?
In 9 hours, I have to be awake. The luck for me is trying to find any time to sleep in that. Probably not, if I'm honest.
It's between the two, because it's an intimate setting between the two of us. We are both chronic insomniacs. I've tried wheeling it in where, like, I try to have a hard cutoff of, like, 2:30 a.m. It's great. It's really healthy.
I'll by 2:30 a.m. I can't do that anymore.
I still can at my own detriment. It's not a good thing that I can still do this. I used to be worse. 4, 5 a.m. used to be the norm for me at one point. Don't be me. Like, seriously, I'm 33 next month. I'm 33 in 2.5 weeks time. Don't be me. It's bad advice. I would not stick to that sort of scheduling. But we do have a lot to talk about over in this next Formula One race, because it was the Belgian Grand Prix this weekend. The rain came down again. We dodged the worst of it, and we actually got a full Grand Prix in this time. So that was nice. And once we did get a Grand Prix underway, we had about 9 laps on intermediates before we all dove in for slicks, and then Oscar Piastri won lights to flag. Whoops. just like God intended. So we'll talk about that, the battle between the McLarens again, a little bit of midfield action, the talks and debates about wet weather racing in general. It's Spa, because of course inevitably an 80-minute rain delay is going to get people talking about, you know, whether Formula One can or should, or whether it should race in the rain at all. People are always going to talk about that. And, well, it looks like the door for silly season's just about closed as well, because it turns out we've had one major domino actually get cemented into the ground rather than fall over. So we'll talk a little bit about that with Max Verstappen as well over the next 45 minutes or so. But before we do that, here's some places you can find us real quick. We're on youtube.com/motorsport101. We're on facebook.com/motorsport101. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can at motorsport_101. If you want to follow us on Blue Sky, you can at dreharrison.bsky.social. RJ O'Connell, as you would expect, for RJ, of course. Also, we've got our website, motorsport101.com, for all the written reviews and to everything you saw this weekend. The Belgian Grand Prix, IndyCar's Grand Prix of Monterey at Laguna Seca, and there'll be a MotoGP mid-season review coming out in the next week or so. And I've got Ask Dre coming out next week as well. So plenty of written stuff to keep you over in the imminent summer break, which we're rapidly approaching in Formula One circles as well next week, once we get past the Hungarian Grand Prix. If you really, really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You can upgrade that to $10 a month if you want to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded, is what Vic, Jason, and Ghost Raptor are doing right now. Thank you very much in the chat for watching along, you mad people. We gave you no notice and you're still here. Absolutely bonkers. Thank you for that. Forgot to mention the video highlights as well. If you want to see video highlights of the pod, you can do so on our Instagram page, motorsport101 pod over on there, and on our TikTok page, m101_podcast. You can do that there as well. Without further ado, after this quick musical break, yes, let's get into the Belgian Grand Prix.
Good stuff. Just really want to talk about Wout Van Aert putting in an incredible wet weather performance to win that final stage. I mean, I know it wasn't his tour. Tadej Pogačar winning it for the fourth time.
Yes,
he might be the best He might be the best ever, and it even includes that guy from Austin, Texas. And I know his don't count, but he might be the best ever to do it. And hang on a minute. I've got the notes for the wrong race here. This is the Formula One Belgian Grand Prix.
That's the one.
A wet to dry affair at historic Circuit Spa-Francorchamps. Yet again, we had an 80-minute rain delay, as Dre mentioned, due to a combination of rain and poor visibility. But we finally got going. The event clock did not start. Pole sitter Lando Norris, on a rolling single-file start, got beaten down the Kemmel the first time of asking by his teammate Oscar Piastri. Piastri would then lead from start to finish after just 9 laps of wet tire running led to Piastri holding onto a pair of medium tires. Norris had to overdrive to make up an 8-second deficit on the hards, make a few minor mistakes along the way. Norris got the gap down to 3.5 seconds, but Piastri held on for the win ahead of Norris. And Charles Leclerc's Ferrari in a very impressive third, very impressive considering how bad things were going on the other side of the Ferrari garage for what, Sir Lewis Hamilton, until Grand Prix Day on Sunday.
Yeah. I mean, we'll talk about Hamilton in a bit there, but yeah, basically having to start the sprint from no man's land, roughly somewhere in Zandvoort, and then having to start the Grand Prix from the pit lane, one of four cars who had to start the race from pit lane because everybody just decided, well, fuck it, might as well take a new power unit while we're here. Because you know, it's the old F1 career mode on a video game exploit where you have a bad qualifying session and you go, sod it, let me just start at the back and take a new engine. Because you know the one you have got isn't reliable enough to get you through more than two rounds. Good old-fashioned trick. I'm a big fan of that. First and foremost, yes, shout out to Tade for winning the Tour de France. As RJ alluded to earlier, we've been watching it on our Discord server all month long. I would say a fantastic contest, but a message to Jonas Vingegaard. Scared money don't make none. As for the Grand Prix itself, I mean, RJ, what did you make of it in real time watching? Because it was a battle of the McLarens at the front again, and this time Piastri came out on top.
First and foremost, I'm glad we got that race in.
Yes.
Right. I'm gonna jump the other point we want to talk about.
Yes, fair enough.
About wet weather racing being phased out by F1. And I understand a number of things. I understand that Spa is not Silverstone. The environment is different. At Silverstone, there are no trees. It's a disused airfield. At Spa, there's plenty of trees. That's part of the attraction, and those retain the spray in the tires. I understand that, contrary to popular belief, Pirelli does not make a useless wet weather tire. The problem is, it's too good. It's too good at moving water. And that kicks up a bunch of spray, combined with the diffusers of modern Formula One cars generating so much downforce that they kick up so much more. That's a big difference between this generation of ground effect cars versus the old one. Back in the 70s and 80s, they didn't kick up this much water.
No.
And the other thing is, as well, I know Spa is very touchy, especially lately, when it comes to running the risk a potentially dangerous situation in single-seater cars. Though that also just means, so why didn't you just put off the F3 and F2 races with drivers that are less experienced in those kinds of conditions at that level? I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. The F3 feature race didn't run. It was deemed too wet to race, and we were this close to a potentially funky situation where Brad Benavidez nearly won an F3 feature race from pole position, which I think junior racing fans would have shit themselves if that had actually gone down. The F2 race went, and I honestly thought that was marginal to whether that race should have even gone ahead. And that thankfully went off without any major incidents in the end, and that
got a second. We got our first podium of the year. We no longer have to look up at Amari Cordial and Rafael Villegas for the standings. We did it. We did it. We won.
Good
but
for
it. So we finished second.
Good for Otomo Miata. It's a fantastic second place, but it does hurt that not only, I mean, fun fact, as a quick side note, Alex Dunn won the F2 feature race on paper. He was hit with a 10-second time penalty because his team, Rodin, didn't operate the startup procedure properly. That promoted Arvid Lindblad to the win, who was then disqualified because his tire pressures were too low. So, with all that in mind, Roman Stanek is an F2 feature race winner.
That's crazy, man.
Shit's wild.
Miata doesn't spin. If Luke Browning doesn't spin.
Luke Browning probably wins that race if he doesn't spin, because Browning was exceptional in the wet, and he screwed himself, really. Talking about the Grand Prix itself, and talking about the weather situation, I mean, you hit the big points on the head already, RJ. The Pirelli intermediate tire is a wonderful tire. It really is. It reminds me of the old Bridgestone intermediate from the V10 days. Mwah, chef's kiss. The single grooved inter that was just that one Ferrari, so many Grand Prix, it was crazy. Pirelli's is kind of like that. It's too good at its job. It clears a boatload of standing water. It's 4 to 5 seconds a lap faster than using the extreme wet. And if it's too wet for an intermediate, chances are it's probably too wet to race at all. Combine that with a diffuser on the rear of these cars and the ground effect that they produce that kicks up so much more spray than the cars of the 80s and 90s did. And you've got a recipe at Spa for not racing, because as RJ said, the trees mean the moisture and the fog and the spray lingers for longer than compared to Silverstone.
Just going to say it. Do not take this as an incentive to cut down all the trees.
No, please
do
don't.
Do not be that guy.
We've done that enough to get to extend Eau Rouge and Rathalon. We don't need any more of that. Spa's beautiful as it is, quite frankly, but no. Yeah. And on top of that, look, I get it. Fans are going to complain because for some, and I know, like, the thing is as well, so I produced the Autosport podcast on this as well, and one of their guys on there is Ronald Vorden, who is absolutely outstanding as a journo, and he talked about the procedure in detail. When they were about to start the race the first time round on the formation lap, 19 out of the 20 drivers complained about poor visibility. Max Verstappen was the outlier. He was the only one who said it was okay to race. Everybody else was like, no, this, we can't see. And quite frankly, as far as I'm concerned, if you cannot see, you cannot race.
Yeah.
I don't know what more needs to be said. If you can't see 6 feet in front of you when driving a 210-mile-an-hour race car, then what are we doing here?
Max Verstappen's an old-school guy, and it probably would have benefited him to run in these conditions.
Sure. Yeah, they slapped the higher downforce rear wing back on the Red Bull after winning the sprint race on Saturday morning. So, of course, Red Bull was going to try and take advantage of that opportunity to reopen Parc Fermé and change their car and then suit it to a race that most people thought was going to be wet on Sunday anyway. It's kind of wild in that sense. But they stopped the race because the drivers can't see.
No problem with that.
No,
I just feel like it felt like Silverstone was a lot worse than some of the conditions that I saw. And a thought crossed my mind. I'm like, Dre, you're entirely right. If we can't see, we can't race. I completely understand. We don't need to throw drivers into needlessly dangerous situations. However, I also feel like we need to find a happy medium between that extreme and the other extreme of we just don't race when there is active rainfall and like the water is just like just below standing.
The thing is that I think this is a Spa problem, not a Formula One problem. Spa and its climate is the big kicker here, because did anybody complain about the conditions at Silverstone when we raced there in the rain for the first two-thirds of that race? We only got a safety car when it was a monsoon on track.
Yeah.
With Piastri having that 15-second lead when it was super wet. And that was immediately after Isaac Hadjar had driven straight into the rear of Kimi Antonelli's car because Hadjar straight up couldn't see him even with his brake lights turned on. So, for me, I think that's a perfectly reasonable cutoff to say, let's neutralize this race. Because again,
no, I agree with that.
And the other example I'd break out is Miami Sprint Race. We got a delayed start because Charles Leclerc aquaplaned on an intermediate tire on what was a glorified straight line. Yeah. If a car is aquaplaning on the intermediate tire in a straight line on a street circuit, again, it's probably too dangerous to continue at that point.
Why is that? Because you have a full wet tire that is just, it's so good, it's unraceable. Think about it.
Yeah.
You have a full wet tire that is exceptional at his job. And because of that, because it moves so much water, you can't race it.
Yeah.
Now, this is not the only culprit as to why visibility is so much poorer than it was back in the days of our childhoods, where the Schumachers, the Hakkinens, the Sennas and Mansells, etc., were racing. But it's just a weird thing to have to explain to people. Like, yeah, your best wet weather tire, your most effective full weather tire is so good you can't race it.
Because it's 5 seconds a lap slower than an intermediate. I remember Japan in 2023 when Mick Schumacher was the only one in extreme wet and he dropped to the back of the field because he was like 5 seconds a lap off the intermediate runners. It's not... Ultimately, it is still a race. And unfortunately, if you're going to be on the wet tire in five laps of clean running, you're going to be a pit stop down on the car behind you. It's just not viable at that point. As I said, the extreme wet, yeah, it's not usable, not because it's bad. It's just because in the context of what Formula One is at this point, it's not realistic to use it. And as I said, if it gets too wet for the intermediates for Pirelli, we probably shouldn't be racing at all to begin with. And even V8, I remember V8 era races like Canada 2011 and Malaysia 2009 were aborted for similar conditions. So this is not a new thing. This is not like a Michael Massey era race direction led issue. This has been happening for years. It's just we pick and choose when to use these examples to say it's too dangerous. Me personally, I think race control largely got this right. I say that because if you can't see, you can't race. It got to a point where the rain had stopped. Most of the standing water had already been taken care of. You had to give a 10-minute warning. Jason in the chat makes a good point. Maybe they could have restarted a lap earlier. The only reason they didn't was because they weren't sure whether to make it a standing start or a rolling start, because there were complaints that people on the right side of the grid was going to be at a disadvantage because the racing line has them on the left-hand side, and that standing water's been cleared. So you've got a big disadvantage on the right-hand side of the grid if you're parked there, and it was deemed unfair. So they went for a single fire rolling start and four laps under the safety car anyway.
Which gets us to the competitive start of the race. Lando Norris does not have enough energy in his battery to go along with the combustion engine, so he cannot get the jump off the restart that he wants, and Oscar just zooms past him, going down the Kemmel straight, and that's pretty much the way that it finishes. I'm glad that we got that race in. It just felt like after everybody switched to slicks, it was just like, damn, I kind of expected a lot more.
It didn't help that Norris botched the sauce on that first lap, and then it's 25 seconds of full throttle pretty much at that point, and you're giving up time all the way down that straight towards Eau Rouge and Radelon, then the Kemmel. And yeah, Norris was a big sitting target after that. It's like the first boss in your video game where the weakness is really obvious and there's a big neon sign saying, fuck me here, basically. It wasn't ideal at all in that sense. And I don't know how much of that was Norris lacking battery. Anthony Davidson explained on the Sky broadcast that it might have been a team call. It might have been that teams in general were struggling to figure out their batteries because they were on a wet track. And, well, the car's computer doesn't know any better when it comes to where to save because they didn't have any really wet running until now. And, yeah, it kind of made Norris a sitting duck. And as you said, RJ and Piastri, we only had 9 laps on the intermediate. By lap 13, everybody had come in for slicks. And Norris lost out there as well. He was too close to Piastri to double stack, so that was off the table. He had to go an extra lap, which is what you don't want to do when you're on inters on a dry track or dry in track, you want to get on the slicks as soon as you can. He had to do an extra lap on them, and he lost a second due to a bad pit stop from McLaren as well. So by the time he came out of the pits, he was 8 seconds behind. And in a straight-up tyre fight, you're not beating Oscar Piastri by 8 seconds over a stint. You're just not. And the thing is, Norris was on the hard tyre. The problem was, and look, this is apparently a Sky problem. Let's just say, and I have it on good record, Sky were trying to spin up the fact the medium tyre might not last. I think it was something in the region of 30 laps to make the end. The teams knew the medium could make it. The teams all pretty much knew. Most of them did because they had the tyre briefing with Pirelli on Thursday, and Pirelli said that the C3 medium was pretty durable and should be able to go the distance.
That is a different conversation about the tyres that Pirelli is making for the Formula One World Championship, opposite the one about their intermediate and full wet tyres.
And the weird thing about this weekend as well is that for the first time ever, Pirelli skipped a compound. Mm-hmm. They went C1-3-4 rather than they normally go 1-2-3 in Belgium. They've gone 2-3-4 before. They went 1-3-4. It's weird because Pirelli was treating this weekend as an experiment to basically stop that medium from being able to go most of the race. They didn't want a repeat of the one stopper that George Russell tried last year to win, in inverted commas. And that's exactly what ended up happening.
Yep.
We got a one stopper, just an unconventional one, because the C3 is durable. And it even at the end, Piastri put in his personal best lap on lap 43. He had enough pace in hand where it was never really going to be a threat. But we all kind of bought the bait with Sky and spun it up into thinking it might be a closer race than it actually was in the end. So, hey, the things you do for entertainment, you know, it's unfortunate. But as you kind of hinted at, RJ, if a medium tyre can do 3/4 of the race distance, then what's the point? Really? How does that make for an interesting or any sort of strategic variance race when the medium can just go forever?
It would apply if we were still in the reality where Oscar Piastri still was having trouble managing his tires. But this is 2025. It's year 3. And that's been one of the biggest improvements in his game since he joined the sport.
Yeah, it's a difference of... And I don't want to get too deep into this with Norris v. Piastri, because I think a lot of people are on one side of the fence or the other with those two.
Pick a side of which highly rated, top prospect pedigreed McLaren driver who is young, conventionally attractive, and to a lot of people has the personality of a bag of stones. Which one do you support? The one for Britain or the one from Australia?
That's what it feels like. And I feel a bit bad for Oscar because he drove a flawless race. Like, from the start, he made the key move early. He got in front. He stayed in front. He never gave Norris an inch, really. Well, there was no chance of a Norris counterattack. And you could maybe make the case that Norris was on the slightly better race sire, especially at the end of the race. But Norris made 2 or 3 minor mistakes. He ran wide at Pujon a couple of times. He locked up at La Source a couple of times. He lost a race by 3.5 seconds, or he made about 4 seconds worth of errors. So people are going to look at the scoreboard, look at the highlights, and immediately assume that Norris choked it. Now, I don't think that's truly the case. I think it's a little bit of both. I think Norris having to make up 8 seconds on a harder compound tire says to me that you're forcing Norris to have to overdrive the car in order to try and make real gains, because Oscar was on the quicker tire to start off with. So, you know, it's one of those things where I feel like Norris was kind of dealt a bit of a bad hand, especially if the battery story turns out wasn't on him. I don't know the full reasoning behind that. So I'm prepared to give him a bit of mitigation in regards to that start, but I feel bad for Oscar because it feels like the narrative's being spun is that Lando choked this race, and it's not as simple as that. Like I don't think Norris lost this race. I think Piastri won it, and I feel like Oscar isn't getting enough flowers for the way he drove that race flawlessly, more than Norris being associated more by his failures than his successes, because it's easy to forget. Before this weekend, Norris had won 3 out of the last 5. He'd got the gap back down to 8 points. Norris was driving better than Piastri for the lot ever since the Canadian crash. Norris has been better. So I just think these are two very evenly matched dudes. Evenly matched dudes. And it's going to be a game of inches that determines who wins this championship, because every weekend we're splitting atoms here about how good these two are.
And that's ultimately what you want in a championship, where we know that Red Bull and Ferrari and certainly Mercedes do not have the goods to fight for a championship in 2025. It's just going to be those two drivers, just like it was in 2023. But the difference is there is not this gulf between Max Verstappen and Checo Perez. The margins are so much thinner. And if you're a neutral observer, this is probably what you want. If you're a McLaren fan, this is what you want, but you have anxiety about it. And if you're a McLaren hater, you're probably just waiting for the FIA to drop something that proves these cars are totally illegal and these guys should be thrown out of the sport. Lando and Oscar should be made to work at Halfords for the next 3 years or so. I don't know, man.
You quoted Halfords. I'm impressed. That's your Anglophile knowledge there. Same color brand as well. Very good. You're right. It is very much a game of splitting hairs at this point. I mean, I was writing my mid-season review on McLaren. I looked at the numbers. Virtually dead level in qualifying head-to-head. Virtually dead level on race results. I looked at the super times average. There was less than a tenth between them. They are extremely close. As close a driver matchup for a championship that I can remember. It's not like Senna and Prost, where there were massive differences in their driving style. Or Rosberg, who, was able to run Hamilton close enough where errors and little tweaks and mistakes define that championship in the end. But we all know Hamilton was marginally better on his day. But with these two, they are so evenly matched that one weekend could swing it one way, like you saw in Austria when Norris bullied Piastri into a mistake that cost him the win. And we now basically saw the complete opposite to that here in Belgium, where it was Piastri that was able to up the pressure on Norris and was able to counter-attack and win this one. So It's going to be a game of inches, and we still have 11 races to go. It's going to be a fascinating title fight in that regard. Look, I'm not going to pretend like I'm enjoying McLaren winning 10 out of 13 so far to start this season, but at least we have a very interesting title fight at the front between the two teammates.
Yeah, Verstappen, I feel, is slipping away, although it did seem like both halves of Red Bull were doing very well in Lauren Mecki's first weekend on the job. Please do not pay attention to Yuki Tsunoda's results. Part of that was influenced by the fact that he got the short end of the stick on strategy, but that was a better all-around weekend than he had compared to the last few weekends where he just looked undriveable. Again, Hamilton was putting on some of the best drives, and I know those are lower midfield end cars that he's driving past. That's still some fun action that he's doing. He's still putting on moves. It's still just like the concept is still there. He didn't completely forget how to drive, despite what either qualifying session will tell you.
Again, you look at the advanced numbers here Leclerc's been better than Hamilton pound for pound all year. Better in qualifying, better in race trim, on average pace, all of the key metrics. Leclerc's been better. Hamilton in qualifying on super times average has only been 0.2 behind. in a brand new car, in a brand new team and environment. And the thing with Hamilton is it's partly our own fault. We probably gaslit him to a degree by thinking he was just going to walk in and immediately challenge for a championship. That was probably... Oh,
we had concerns. We had concerns off the rip that, hold on a second, hold on. I know it's Sir Lewis, but number 8 is not in the bag just because he makes this move to a team that looks like it has more upward momentum than Mercedes does.
I just said it from day one. I said the concern was he was outclassed by George Russell in his last year at Mercedes, and you're walking into Charles Leclerc's house. Charles Leclerc is one of the best drivers in the world, has been for some time. You don't run that dude over. He's too good. He's, as Sarah Spain was saying, ESPN, he's unfuckwithable in that sense. And yeah, like, the reality, like most things in when it comes to assessing sports takes, are it's somewhere in the middle. It's nowhere near the your goat is washed argument, but it isn't the number 8 is coming to town, because the reality of the situation is if he's not going to beat Charles, he's not winning number 8. That's just point blank, and he needs to start beating Charles more regularly if we're going to have that kind of conversation. But the man's not terrible. Yeah. Right, he went from the pit lane to P7, drove brilliantly, was the first man to put on the slicks in those conditions, took advantage of it and got himself in a pocket where he was able to jump the entire midfield and was then able to just basically follow Alex Albon. Couldn't get past him because we all know how hard it is to pass a Williams on a high-speed track. Good luck with that. But it was still a very good drive. One driver of the day, and it wasn't just a fantasy team thirsty owner's push. There was a genuine case you could make that Hamilton was driver of the day on that one. And it was a really, really good P7 performance.
Yeah. Glad to agree with all that. Other big thing that broke down going into the weekend, and certainly coming out of it, it looks like we're not going to get the blockbuster transfer of the 2025-26 offseason.
Damn it!
Thought there was a glimmer of hope, but it seems like Max Verstappen has closed the door on him moving away from Red Bull, at least for the year. He's given his commitment to Red Bull for 2026, with Red Bull in return offering Max no resistance if he wants to leave for 2027. Shutting down rumors of a Mercedes switch for next year. We don't have to like the guy, but Dr. Helmut Marko pretty much said he's not going, and now puts the ball in the court of George Russell Mercedes. We're now currently close to an extension of his own for multiple years. Not just one, not just two, multiples. Okay, so just like the old meme, nothing ever happens, but it's still worth talking about. Mm. Do we think that everybody's making the right move? Because to me, it's just like, I know 2026 is going to be a big year, but you at least want to play out the field. Maybe Mercedes does have the best power unit of 2026 and beyond. Maybe Ford does have their pants around their ankles, their shoelaces tied together and on fire. So you get a chance to assess that and then make your moves from there.
He's still Max Verstappen. He still holds all the aces, in the sense of if Max Verstappen enters the open market in the middle of 2026, there will be teams immediately looking at their contracts, thinking about how they could potentially make room for him. I think the only two teams that wouldn't touch it entirely would be probably McLaren and Ferrari, who have their driver lineup set going forward. Unless Ferrari were to pull a shocker and tell Lewis Hamilton not to come to work anymore, which I don't think would happen.
You could buy a Kimi Raikkonen, and I don't think you can buy a Lewis Hamilton.
That would be a very expensive, please don't come to work anymore. And
very unpopular one.
And there would be riots in the streets of Maranello. Like, I could guarantee you that. I think everybody involved was playing each other for suckers on this one. And I think the case in point of that was that the moment Max Verstappen basically gave the verbal commitment that he was staying for next year, Mr. George Russell, who claimed in Belgium that same weekend that he hadn't been offered a contract yet, all of a sudden, 3 days later, Planet F1 is reporting that he's been given a 2-year contract extension till the end of 2027. So either George is shitting or Toto drew up a contract in record time, like Aprilia trying to get Jorge Martin without the buyout clause.
Who was on that plane? Who was on that plane to Sardinia?
Well, the thing is that they live right next to each other. They're going to talk. They've always been talking. But of course, the timing, the Christian Horner firing, you know, Red Bull being out of form, the public knowledge of a release clause that kicked in if he wasn't going to... Because for those who don't know, Verstappen's contract had a release clause. He could leave at the end of this season if he was outside of the top three by the summer break.
That, now he can't be overtaken.
Nope, because he's 27 points clear of George Russell in the standings in fourth place with one race to go. So it's impossible for Verstappen to lose. And to be fair, even before then, Eric Van Haren, the Telegraph, had reported that Max had given a verbal word that he was staying. So yeah, the clause didn't even really matter in the end. So I think everybody across the table has played each other and played us for suckers. Personally, I said from day one, even with Horner going, I didn't imagine Max was ever really going to leave, because why would you leave a year before a regulation change? That just doesn't seem very clever to me. I think that just seems far too risky, personally. And Mercedes might have the best power unit, but you don't truly know for sure until they're all on track and they race each other. That's ultimately the case in point. And I think the only drawback for Max now is if George Russell signs this 2-year extension, does that put the pressure on Kimi Antonelli at Mercedes instead?
Yeah, that's something that I was starting to worry about, because Kimi Antonelli has cooled off a bit these last few races. It has gone more like the sort of form you expect out of a driver who was rushed rapidly up the ladder, seemingly quicker than he should have, rather than the prospect to be like, it's okay that he's being rushed up the ladder. He's that good. Look at the sim data. Look at everything he did before Formula 2. It was good at times, this Formula 1 season. He got the podium in Canada. Since then, in Grand Prix, he's retired from two in a row. He finished 16th in Belgium. He's retired out of the last, what, 4 out of the last 7 Grand Prix? It's not been great.
The concerning thing of Antonelli is that his public interviews talk like a man who's openly admitted he's lost confidence. And that's not ideal for where a rookie is right now. You want your rookie to have confidence in his car and confidence in how he's driving and that he's doing the right things. Because as you said, it's not like this has all been bad. We still have the Miami sprint pole. We still have the podium in Canada where he drove the nuts off that thing and was not far away from genuinely racing Verstappen for second. It could have been a Mercedes 1-2 that day in Montreal. I am concerned because Antonelli's only signed a 1-year deal with Mercedes. I think he'll get an extension for next year. But what happens in 2026 if Max hits the market? Is Toto going to ignore a third year of Max negotiations, especially given he's just given George Russell an extension in his own right? And right, Russell's been superb this season. No doubt about that. He deserved an extension. But the problem here is that, are you going to let go of the super talent to bring in Max to have a win now team instead?
Super talent that you brought in to directly replace the face of the franchise, registered trademark.
The guy you've been seeing from age 12 to try and get him ready for this nearly a decade later.
Imagine if Lewis Hamilton was cut by McLaren after 2008 and if things didn't go well. You know what it reminds me of? It's like Jenson Button debuting in Formula One at 20, which was very impossibly young back then. But he's not good enough to be on a team that was a outside title contender of Williams BMW at that time. So they just loan him out. He never eventually comes back until he's, you know, an advisor to the team after he's retired from Formula One driving.
Yeah, Jenson Button. Yeah, it's an interesting one that. Me, personally, I feel bad for Kimi because there's been no middle ground with that kid. There's been other people that just think this is far too soon. This is crazy. What are you doing? And there have been people that I know that know their wheel that were adamant that this guy was the chosen one from the time he was in Fracker. And again, I think the answer is somewhere in the middle. I didn't see enough of him in Formula 2 where I'm going, oh my God, this guy's the truth. I could
He put on that feature pass at Spa.
Yeah. And look, he won two races in Formula 2 last year, and the two he did win were spectacular. I could see why people got excited about it. I totally get why. The upside is enormous on this kid.
Yeah, Max Verstappen wasn't European Formula 3 champion in 2014.
Nope. And that's my point.
It doesn't matter.
Like, I think everybody needs to just chill the F out and let this kid focus on his driving. He's not going anywhere. Mercedes are not contending for a championship. His numbers are behind George, and they should be. George has been incredible this season. Like if the expectation was beat George right away, you're just sipping on a cup of Delulu, and the Delulu is not this. But I am a little bit concerned that he may end up being sacrificed if Max truly is available next year and Antonetti was seemingly the anti-Max, if that makes sense. So why have the anti-Max and you got the real thing? It's
right.
You know, it could be one of those sorts of situations. Yeah. And that
McLaren could have gambled. They could have stuck with Kevin Magnussen or 10 years ago. They could have put former world champions Fernando Alonso and Jenson Button together on the same team in the first year of the McLaren-Honda reunion. We know how it went. And I didn't agree with the decision at the time, but I understood. I understood what they were thinking.
If you're Mercedes, if you have the opportunity to sign Max, you sign Max and you ask questions later. I get it. It would be really shit for Antonetti, but I understand why.
Same with Lewis to Ferrari last year. You know, there's an argument that can be made that Carlos Sainz was not so bad that he didn't need to be moved off. But if you sign Lewis Hamilton, if you have the chance to sign Lewis Hamilton, you do it. That's it. Like I said, Yuki Tsunoda had a fun midfield race that didn't turn out a result they needed. Pierre Gasly was in the midst of this stuff. Dre, what do you want to get to before we start to wrap things up here on this episode?
A couple of things. Like, once again, Pierre Gasly is driving the nuts off that Alpine. Like, you think Red Bull's bad? Gasly's the only driver that scored 100% of his team's points in the paddock this year. He has 20 in what many consider the worst car in the sport right now. Like, I can't believe I'm saying this. Given that Hülkenberg finally got his flowers for Silverstone, Pierre Gasly is a low-key top five driver of the year so far this season. He's been immense for that Alpine team, and I feel like he's actually not getting enough credit for how well he's driving at the moment. I said it in my mid-season review, his sixth place at Silverstone will be the worst sixth place that never gets talked about because of Hülkenberg's podium. It's a bad deal. I feel bad for Gasly because he is driving exceptionally well this year and is not getting the credit he deserves for it. He's doing excellent work with that Alpine. Feel bad for Yuki that he deserved a point or two in this race. He clearly had, in my opinion, his best weekend for Red Bull so far this year. But
It's its own race.
Yeah, Lauren Mekki screwed him. Oh, he got a bad call. They had enough time between Verstappen and Yuki to double stack him and put them both in on the same lap, but he'd already gone past the pit entry point by the time that Red Bull had made the call. So he had to do an extra lap and it put him behind Gasly again. And that hurt him because he just couldn't get past a low downforce setup Alpine on that straight. And yeah, it probably cost Yuki some points. It's a shame, unfortunately, on that one. But yeah, the midfield bar fight is going to be fascinating. And you're seeing the whole bottom half of the table is going to be beefing with each other. And yeah, it's going to lead to some chaos. Williams, Kitsama, and Bortoleto got eighth place in this, or ninth place in this race, and no one cared. Shit's wild. like both Sabers are scoring points now on a regular basis.
And most importantly, they are gone at the end of the season.
Yes.
Thank goodness.
Kick is on, because Revolut will be the title sponsor of the Audi F1 team next year. Hooray!
We can talk about the ethics of the new title sponsor all we want a future episode down the line if we ever need to do it. I'm just glad that they're gone. 23 points separates Sauber in sixth from Alpine in 10th.
Alpine are the worst team in Formula 1 and they have 20 points through 13 races.
8 points separating sixth from 9th.
Yeah, Haas, Ocon's trying his best out there. Oli Bearman's finished 11th place for 4 races in a row now, which is wild. I think only 8 or 9 drivers have ever finished in the same place 4 times in a row, and it wasn't for a win. It's a unicorn out there. Racing Bulls were nowhere really. Certainly not with Hadjid, their lead driver. He just had engine problems. That didn't help him either.
Good for Liam Lawson, though. He needs results like this.
To back up the Siegfried going in Austria, which was a career high result. Yeah. Lawson seems
that's
to be finding
more
his,
like it.
Seems to be finding his confidence again, which is good to see. I'm glad that Lawson's been able to salvage something with some good races lately. Definitely.
Yeah. Also, Dre, what's this I hear about Istanbul Park being the big guy in the yellow suit at the funeral, hanging behind the tree, licking his lips and rubbing his hands together just in case somebody drops off the calendar?
That's just it. Like, Istanbul Park's promoters came out and basically said today, I think as a matter of fact, or yesterday even, that we'll happily fill in if any race doesn't make it, which I think is a very pointed way of saying we don't think Madrid's going to be finished in time. That's what that is, because all the tracks that are on next year's calendar, there's no risk of them not being able to take part unless something catastrophic happens, right? Apart from Madrid. That's the one race where it's like they're not ready to go yet. They're not done. So I think this is Turkey's way of trying to worm itself back on the calendar.
Hey, girl, I know you've got this day coming up, and I just want to say, you know, no worries if you can't make it out, but I'd love to hang out just in case plans fall through. I mean, I know you're worried about this guy standing you up or anything, and I'm not making any advances or anything. I'm just saying if you need somebody to hang out with in case it goes sideways, you know, hit me up. I'm always available, girl.
You up? That's what I could boil down RJ's entire speech to 2 words. You up? Because that's what this is. And Kira in our chat made a very good point. Baku is under a degree of threat because a lot of people don't know or are seemingly forgotten. Azerbaijan is currently in a war with Armenia, as you do, and has been for years. And their contract's up for renewal at the end of the year and the next year. And that might not get renewed. So there's a lot up in the air that Baku might not happen. Madrid might not happen, depending on. And look, when Imola stepped up to fill in during COVID times, Imola stuck around for half a decade. That is a boatload of money made if you're a promoter. If Istanbul can worm its way on the calendar, it might be able to stick around for a while if it's a dependable race that they can go to, even if it's a rotational race, because we know that Spa's on rotation once 2027 kicks in, and I don't think it'll be the only one by the time we get there. Then there's a lot of competition at the moment. Rwanda's competing for a race. Thailand's competing for a race. South Korea wants back in. And there's only 24 spots to fill. So good luck.
Yeah, good luck with that. We've got Hungary up next. The Hungarian Grand Prix. In a weekend that also includes the Suzuka 8 hours. Assuming the weather play ball, because there is a typhoon on the way to central Japan. Maybe there was a giant earthquake off the coast of Russia that had tsunami advisories kicked up halfway across the globe of the west coast of the United States. Hopefully the weather will play ball and we'll be able to get all that in.
Yeah. Magnitude 8.8. Enormous earthquake that was. Enormous. Fingers crossed, and obviously hope that everybody out there can is as well as they can be given the circumstances, because tsunamis are no fucking joke. They are horrible. I know Japan is the best prepped country in the world for them, but it still is dangerous as all hell. So fingers crossed everything works out. And then most importantly, people stay safe, of course.
Sure, for sure.
We'll have to wait and see. Busy weekend of motorsport. Otherwise, Suzuka 8 hours. We have got Formula One at the newly revamped Hungaro Ring as well, because you've got a brand new main grandstand and paddock building. Looks gorgeous. They did a really good job turning that round in a year. Let me tell you, that was not easy. A lot of cranes involved to get that ironed out. So we'll have to wait and see how that plays out as well. And yeah. That's it. It's weird. Like for the really big stuff we normally cover on here, it's weird not having a doubleheader weekend for the first time
I'm not even gonna push the fact that I'm gonna be at IMSA for Road America. You know, one of your favorite tracks. God, you gotta come out here, it's great.
Oh, I want Bratz and Taylor Tots, damn it. Oh, I love Road America. Oh well, have a good time out there, buddy.
Appreciate it. But you'll hear me again soon. Because we got to talk about IndyCar Laguna Seca.
It won't take long, but you could probably guess who won. Yeah, that damn Spaniard. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison. He's been RJ O'Connor. We'll see you next time. Thank you very much for listening. Sayonara. Damn, this is the part where Cam Buckley's got a witty line to close out the episode.
Couldn't be me.